On this episode of the DFA podcast, we talk more about the Rays, we talk about a bunch of minor moves, and we even talk about our favorite Toby Hall memory. It's a DFA podcast. It's coming at you right about now.
Welcome to episode 53 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, my co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, we got more Rays stuff to talk about. How pumped are you?
I'm getting ready to sign off now.
Yeah, this is we have the option here of just letting RJ rant for a half an hour on the Rays and the state of things in Tampa, but fortunately we'll jump in and we'll maybe smooth off some of the rough edges a little bit. But I think you've got a right to be a little frustrated, your former team of choice at this point.
My spirit has been broken, Ryan. While that's happened before, never to this degree.
Yeah, it's a rough time in Tampa. Also joining us is our producer and sometime co-host, Sean Brody. Sean, are you excited to be back in the swing of things with probably a dozen or more little moves to talk about at the end of the show?
Yeah, it's kind of weird that we're giving RJ the chance to run with the Rays. He's usually giving us a chance to run with the Mets, so it feels like apt payback.
Yeah, to be fair, though, once we get the season started, the Mets and all their injuries will give us plenty of chances to talk more about everyone's favorite second-class team in New York once we get into May and June and everybody's arms falling off. So we'll get there. We'll get there, I'm sure.
Both teams are used to being second-class to the Yankees in their respective cities. So
that is harsh and definitely true. We're going to start things off with some Rays talk. We're going to get into the many, many moves that they've made recently, as well as some breaking news, literally and figuratively, as we record this about one of their starting pitchers. But I guess we will start with the first of a couple of moves that the Rays made recently, since the last time we talked about the Rays, which was only a few days ago. The biggest probably move in terms of moving parts is definitely a three-way trade that they've made with the Yankees and with the Diamondbacks. And, you know, the Rays have a really bad history with three-way trades, so why not throw another one out there? They also signed Carlos Gomez, the outfielder, to a one-year, $4 million contract. And they finally shipped off DFA'd outfielder Corey Dickerson to the Pirates in return for Daniel Hudson, a prospect, and $1 million in cash. So, RJ, we're going to let you start things off. Do you want to talk about the Rays in aggregate? Do you want to talk about one of the moves in particular? Where do you want to start us off?
I think we should start with the Souza trade. And I'll just begin by noting that it seems like you're allowed to trade outfielders now without designating them for assignment. Weird how that happens, because I thought they said that you have to designate them for assignment around this time of the year.
But I want to focus. Misconception.
Yes, I want to focus on Anthony Banda, because I watched a couple of his starts and he seems fine. He seems like a back and starter. He seems like he's pretty close to major league ready. And there are just two things that I want to say that I think they're going to tweak with him. And number one, he has one of those backspin heavy fastballs. It appears that Arizona had him pitching down in the zone a lot, which makes sense because you probably don't want to be, you know, an extreme fly ball guy in that ballpark, especially not when the ball is juiced. However, I think we both know where I'm going with this. I totally see the Rays telling him to pitch up more to elevate that heater, probably going to get sufficient swing throughs to justify it, and so on and so forth. The other thing I think they might tweak is his delivery. Because when you watch Banda, he doesn't really always have the best line to home plate, and that affects his command and control. It's something you see the Pirates do a lot with their pitchers. And, you know, you watch Banda's back foot, and it seemed like his foot actually made a horizontal movement before going forward. So I think they might try to clean up his line a little bit and see if he can't throw more strikes and more quality strikes. Because, you know, the potential is here for a three-pitch lefty who can probably eat innings. He seems athletic. Yeah, and he kind of reminds me of Gustavo Chacin because he's a lefty with goggles, but that's kind of besides the point. But what do you think about this deal?
So I probably don't hate this deal as much as many folks do. So let's break it down piece by piece. The Rays are getting rid of Steven Souza. Steven Souza is going to go to Arizona. Anthony Banda is going from Arizona to the Rays, along with two players to be named later. Brandon Drury is going from the Diamondbacks to the Yankees, and the Yankees are sending infield prospect Nick Solak to the Rays as well. So the Rays pick up Banda, Solak, and the two players to be named later in exchange for Steven Souza. I'm glad you brought a little bit of research and knowledge about Anthony Banda, because I was starting to feel uncomfortable with Banda's future as a effective starter. I think he's the type of guy with, given his pitch mix, he's going to stay a starter. But I was very nervous about him being an effective major league starter, given his poor performance in Reno, which he had PCL, and then poor performance in Arizona, and yeah, it's Arizona. He just hadn't been looking too sharp last year, like you said. That having been said, he does seem like a very Raysy, reclamation-y pitcher, like you said. I wouldn't be terribly surprised if he rights the ship and becomes a three-ish, four-ish starter in Tampa, especially with that park helping him out. But Steven Souza's pretty good, and getting rid of him, when you combine that with losing Dickerson, when you combine that with losing Evan Longoria, and when you combine that with losing Logan Morrison, who's pretty much gone, is not only have you traded away half of your starting lineup from last season, you traded away the best half of your starting lineup from last season. I like Steven Souza. I don't love Steven Souza. I think that he was probably hitting over his head a little bit maybe last year. I'm still a little concerned by his strikeout rate, especially when paired with his low walk rate. But I do think the Rays kind of sold high on him. And if you're selling high on Steven Souza, getting back Anthony Banda, Nick Solak, and two prospects seems a little light.
Yeah, I guess it depends on who the two players to be named later are. I will say, like you mentioned earlier, I don't hate this as much as I dislike the other deals. And, you know, in Souza's case, I do feel like he was overperforming last season. And I want to note something that we can probably we probably do overlook. And that's that he's going to be 29 years old in late April. He's not really young. I mean, he wasn't young to begin with when they acquired him, but he's getting pretty close to that point where you start to get worried about a guy with his skill set. You mentioned the strikeouts. You know, he pops up a fair amount. To his credit, he did up his walk rate last season, but you know, it's very much a offensive profile that could crater. And yeah, if the ball isn't juiced, it's possible that he's more of a 20 to 25 home run guy than 30. And I also note he's always had durability issues. He played 110 games his first year in Tampa, 120 his second, 148 last year. But this dude, I didn't watch the Rays as much as I usually do last season because, I mean, come on. But this dude, I feel like every game was grabbing his wrist and freaking out anytime the ball got close to him. And, hey, I would do the same thing. You know, nothing against that. It's just he's seemingly more of an injury risk than the average bear. And, all you know, 3 years playing on turf probably won't help him as he matures further. And I think he's probably one to two win player, maybe a little bit better, maybe a little bit worse, but I don't think he's a 4+1 player heading forward.
Yeah, so. And are you a little put off by how bad he was at the second half of last season, or do you consider that just part of the fact that he's got a profile that'll end up being a little more streaky than your average hitter because of his, you know, low walk, high strikeout, needs to make contact sort of batting profile?
Not really, because I kind of defer to the larger sample with him. Yeah. So, you know, the variance within a season isn't as important to me as the story overall. And again, with his skill set, like you said, he's probably more prone to those swings. So understanding that and understanding, you know, how that skill set tends to, let's say, carry a lot of attrition risk with it as the guy gets older and older, I think those are more important than any single split within a season.
Yeah, so to replace Souza in the outfield, the Rays have brought in Carlos Gomez on a 1-year, $4 million contract. I wasn't super, super a fan of the Steven Souza deal. However, I am super, super a fan of the Gomez signing. I think this is an incredible value on a player who's going to do many of the same things Souza was going to do. He may not be as good of a hitter as Souza, but he may be as good of a hitter as Souza. He's coming in on a very cheap, for the team, very, very bad contract for him, I would think. I was expecting him to get more than 1-4. But he carries a lot of the same profile. He's a guy who kind of sells out for power at this stage in his career. Defense is probably going to be similar to Souza's, where he can bust out a couple of, you know, really great moves in a corner, but isn't able to play center field anymore. A bit of an injury risk, and a bit of a performance risk, honestly, after his time in Houston. But I do think there was a comparison made on FanGraphs by, I think it was Jeff Sullivan, that they're getting a very Souza-like player in Carlos Gomez, who isn't even really that much older than Souza. And I really do like this move from a value and performance on the field perspective. What are your thoughts?
No, I like this deal. Independent of the Souza deal, in conjunction with it, yeah. I mean, you're basically trying to get approximately the same production or thereabout. I will say Gomez, you know, he has some attrition risk himself because he was so awful with Houston. And we talked about the second half splits for Souza. We talked about them for Dickerson. And, you know, people keep referencing those as proof that Dickerson's not going to be good heading forward. Carlos Gomez was horrible away from Texas last season. I mean, horrible. I think his OPS was like 650 or thereabout on the road. I don't think that's particularly meaningful because basically every batter is better at home. And, you know, some guys are just going to be better at home by a wide margin. You know, we're talking like 50 games for him both ways. So, again, it's just not a huge sample. It's nothing I would read too much into. But I don't know. That and the reverse splits last season, there's probably some reason to say, you know what? You know, maybe there's something here, especially if you're looking at Dickerson and Souza as quickly as a lot of people seem to be. But from my perspective, I agree with you. This is fine. This is good even. And he'll probably be, you know, maybe a two-win player, probably 1 to 1.5. That's good.
So if we were only talking about the Rays in the lens of if they only made these two moves, hey, we're going to trade away Steven Souza, we're going to bring back some prospects, we're going to replace him with Carlos Gomez, you and I and the rest of the internet would probably be saying, hey, good job, Rays. You're being efficient. You're being smart given the constraints you're operating under. Everything is great. But this isn't the only pair of moves they've made this offseason. We talked a little bit previously about how they brought in CJ Krohn to maybe be their Logan Morrison replacement. We talked about how the team DFA'd Corey Dickerson without, as far as we know, having a trade lined up for him. Now, we do have a trade that has been made where Dickerson's heading to the Pirates. Coming back is going to be Daniel Hudson. Coming back is going to be an infield prospect and $1 million. They did trade away Jake Odorizzi. They did trade away Evan Longoria. When you look at these moves in the aggregate, all of them together, it paints a very different picture. It paints a picture of a team that's not just being efficient, but to me it feels like a team that is trying to be efficient and trying to play the long game with getting player control and decreasing salary at the expense of the short term, perhaps the medium term and the long term, and at the expense of benefit of the doubt from fans and analysts, at the expense of morale of their team. I mean, these moves where you've traded away Dickerson, Souza, Longoria have been met with, I would say, general disdain from not only the public, but from the literal players on the Rays roster. Ostensibly, they were going to replace Jake Odorizzi in the rotation with Brent Honeywell. News has just come out that Brent Honeywell has torn his UCL and will not be able to pitch next year as he goes under the knife for Tommy John surgery. Corey Dickerson.
They might sign Chris Dickerson to replace Corey Dickerson.
Is gone, and his replacement is likely to be, you know, Denard Span or Malik Smith. What do you think of the Rays as a team right now? And I know you've got some strong opinions on that, but I want to hear you share them again.
I think they're sub 500. I mean, how could you think they're – I just don't agree with the Bakota projections. I don't agree with the idea that they lost nothing here. And, you know, you look at – there's you know, articles out there saying, oh, they're, you know, they're just as good as they were before they traded Odorizzi and Dickerson, you know, before they did the Souza-Gomez stuff and all that. And I just don't believe that because at minimum, you're getting rid of depth. And, you know, if you say that Dickerson and Odorizzi are both two-win players – maybe you say they're 1.5. That's 3 wins right there. That's not meaningless for a team that's going to be basically fighting on the fringe for a playoff spot, most likely. Their bench is awful. They could have definitely have used, you know, if you say, even if you say Dickerson would have been a bench player, injuries happen. Denard Span has missed on an average of like 50 games over the last 3 seasons. He's probably not going to appear in 130-plus games for this team. Having a guy like Dickerson to step in, that helps your team. You know, it helps you instead of having to rush Jake Bowers or whatever minor leaguer they would have, or whatever, you know, non-roster guy they would have ran out there in place of Bowers if the injury happened too early in the year. You know, same with Odorizzi. Like, Nate Eovaldi, best case scenario, might be having a good Jake Odorizzi season. And I want to talk about the Daniel Hudson move here because people were beating their chest over getting Hudson in return for Dickerson. Here's the thing. This fan base and some people who quote-unquote get it have basically buried Odorizzi over one bad season. They buried Corey Dickerson over one bad half. They may or may not have buried Souza over one bad half. Honestly, I didn't even read the analysis of that. Daniel Hudson over the last 2 seasons has been worth negative 0.7 war. That's a negative 0.7 war season in 2016 and zero last year. How in the world do you bury those other guys and then embrace Hudson like that? There's no logic there whatsoever. And I just want to know, I like Hudson. I think his stuff is better than his results. I thought he was a good value signing for the Pirates. I just do not understand how people were beating their chest like this is some huge win to get him when really the Pirates got a great deal here. They got a potential above average outfielder for a guy who, frankly, probably had no part in their bullpen and who was going to cost them, you know, $5 million to potentially be below replacement level for a third consecutive season or at replacement level for a third consecutive season.
Yeah. So real quickly, I have a couple of things I want to say there. So first of all, the Rays have obviously been working to dump payroll, but the Dickerson deal, it only dumps like $2 million in payroll because of Hudson's salary and the $1 million coming back. So that one is a weird one to me because you're giving up a useful player in a position of need. Yes, you needed a relief pitcher, and we can talk a little bit more about Hudson and what his projections are going forward, but they didn't cut a lot of salary here. They got measurably worse for a tiny bit of salary relief, which to me is the type of the – that and the fact that Dickerson was DFA'd and the team was forced to move him at that point tells me that the team – wanted nothing to do with him, and that they were trading from a position of desperation. And like I've said on previous episodes, if you're dealing from a position of desperation, you're going to lose the trade because you are not waiting for the best offer. You are not negotiating from a position of strength.
Yeah.
Now, as far as Hudson and why people are beating their chest over that while they were down on Souza or Dickerson or anybody else, when you're a fan of the team – or when you're an analyst that wants to believe that the team is doing something right, you're going to cherry pick your stats. So you talked about Hudson being, you know, worth a zero war from 2016 to 2017. If you look at Baseball Prospectus, he's worth about a win and a half over that period. So different analytic systems are going to give you different answers as to how valuable a guy is or how valuable they're going to be going forward. I think that it's easy to – if you're already predisposed to support these moves, you may want to cherry pick the stats from Baseball Prospectus or from FanGraphs instead of the stats from Baseball Reference or somewhere else. I think that's human nature. I don't even want to be that critical of that. What I do think is that the Rays are also cherry picking their own stats. They have their own algorithms. They have their own projection systems. And from all the history that we have, especially when you talk about first baseman, some of the other moves they've made in the past, I don't think the Rays systems look particularly like what the public-facing systems look like for valuation of players, because it is not an infrequent thing where they will go out and they will go after somebody and the different systems may say, huh, this is kind of a weird move. Like, why are they investing heavily in Casey Kochman? Or why are they investing heavily in Steven Souza? Yeah, Pakoda thinks he's going to be great, but most of the rest of the analytics sphere is a little bit more bearish on him. So I think that may have something to do with it as well.
That makes sense. And yeah, I don't know. I just have a hard time getting too psyched over the Dickerson deal on any side other than the Pirates side. And again, I like Hudson. I'm rooting for him. He seemed like a very likable dude, especially if you read his story and Jeff Passan's The Arm. I am just realistic here that it's possible he's not very good anymore. It's possible, you know,
right,
all that time off and, you know, even the time on the mound has just, you know, caused his body to get to the point where he's not an effective pitcher. And I think I would prefer Dickerson 100 out of 100 times there. And, you know, that Craig Goldstein tweet keeps popping in my head throughout the Rays offseason. The one Rays says, you know, Billy Bean makes 20 moves and they're confusing and it leaves the team slightly cheaper but slightly worse. And, you know, their response is, oh, I see it. Whereas, you know, when a team like the National sides Max Scherzer, people are like, well, that makes no sense because they're paying him too much or whatever.
Right.
That's been the Rays offseason to a T. They are slightly worse. They're slightly cheaper, I think, and it's really just been for nothing. Like, you know, it's all this song and dance where Tristan Gray, who was a 13th round pick last year out of Rice, probably not. Like, no one seems to think he's a legitimate prospect. Palacios, again, we talked about him last episode. He was the 31st ranked guy in the Twin system. I had someone I trust tell me that he wouldn't rank in the Rays top 30 for him, at least. So I don't know. It just seems like a lot of movement with very little substance. And it's almost like you know, I know this gets overused, but it's like a kid playing a video game and just trying to check out the trade AI and trying to accumulate as many little pieces as possible, you know, to fill out his roster or whatever. And I don't think all of this busy work is really making them better for the long haul or the short haul or the medium haul, any kind of haul, even the Cody haul. I don't think that's how he makes them much better. So
the Toby haul?
You know, here's the thing about Toby Hall for you listeners out there. Toby Hall once used the magic stick as his walk-up song. So shout out to you, Toby Hall, if you're listening for some ungodly reason, because that is the one thing I remember about you.
I'm with you. I completely agree that the Rays are worse for 2018. They're worse for 2019. They're worse for 2020. Even though I'm okay with the Souza deal, and I actually very much like it in conjunction with the Gomez deal, it's not looking good in Tampa. They're working to get into a new stadium, but I have no faith that when they get into the new stadium, they'll start spending copious amounts of money or that they'll eventually have figured out how to draft, which they have done such a poor job in the draft over the last decade. Almost remarkably so.
Brian, can I go on record with one thing about the draft?
Sure.
I would have taken Kyle Wright over Brendan McKay.
Well, that's great. I mean, Brendan McKay could still work out, you know, either as a number three starter or an average first baseman, or probably not both. But, you know, it could happen for him. So
absolutely. He could be a fine player. And if, you know, Michael Bauman compared him to J.A. Happ or James Loney, and both of those guys had, what, 8+ years in the majors? I mean, we laugh because that's not really what you want out of your number four pick, but – realistically, if you could have J.A. Happ's career, you take that.
That's great. Yep.
Yeah. I just like Kyle Wright more, and I liked him more leading up to the draft, and I think the Braves got a very, very good value at number five, and it wouldn't surprise me if he is potentially, you know, eventually a number two starter. I like that package a lot. So that's kind of a little aside on – we don't really talk prospects that much, so I just wanted to throw that one in there while we were talking about the Rays and their draft troubles.
So let's really rather quickly go over the teams that are receiving these former Rays or former Diamondbacks players. We talk – since we're kind of on the subject, let's talk about Dickerson on the Pirates. This is a weird fit to me with him going to the Pirates. The Pirates already have Adam Frazier, who they sometimes seem to like and sometimes don't. They've got Austin Meadows, who probably is about done with AAA. Whether that means he's going to be good in the majors or not is still kind of an open question. But those are two left-handed hitting outfielders who they already had. They also happen to sign Michael Saunders to a minor league deal, which I think he should probably pack up his locker and head out now while the getting is good. The Dickerson acquisition, I think, is good. I think it's a good decision for the Pirates. If you have the opportunity to add depth or to add an upgraded player, go ahead and do it, especially when the cost is as cheap as it was for the Pirates. But it is kind of a weird fit, I feel like, because they're going to give Gregory Polanco every chance to succeed in right field. Starling Marte is going to be the center fielder unless he gets suspended or something. And Dickerson is going to be the left fielder and probably not going to play much first base with Josh Bell there. They've got a lot of outfielders. They could easily turn around and make another move and make another deal. But for a team that kind of they're not full tanking, but they're definitely in a rebuilding phase. I like the addition of Dickerson because he is a good short-term stopgap that will keep your team from being embarrassing. I just don't know for sure if there's another move coming because it seems like they're kind of overloaded.
Yeah, and they also have Daniel Nava, who was better last season than you would have expected, and Bryce Brentz, who's probably not really someone you should build your roster around or anything, but he could.
But also Brentz is the right-handed hitter, so he could be the platoon guy.
Yeah, I don't know. I like Dickerson more than all those options. So
really? More than Austin Meadows?
Because Austin Meadows is almost always hurt, Brian.
He is. I agree.
That's not a commentary on Meadows as a prospect. It's just I think if you're entering the season, it's perfectly fine to have a veteran insurance policy. And, you know, Meadows, yeah, he's got to stay healthy. And realistically, were they going to bring him up before Super 2 anyway? Probably not. So I could see Meadows debuting late in the year. And, you know, if Dickerson goes out there and hits like he can hit, maybe they trade him at the deadline and get a decent return. Or maybe they do trade Polanco or – I can't see them trading Marte, but you know, then again, I guess I couldn't see them trading Gerrit Cole for what they traded him for. So
good point.
We'll see. Plus, injuries happen. I mean, injuries always happen.
Yeah, no, I'm with you 100%. I think it's a great deal for the Pirates. I think it's a good choice. I was surprised because it didn't seem like they need an outfielder, but just like you said, either as a hedge or as a regular number two hitter or as you know, anything else, get the best bad ball hitter in baseball, put him in your lineup, and let everything else kind of sort itself out. So then let's talk about the other outfielder. So Souza goes to the Diamondbacks. He's probably the insurance policy because they could not re-sign or were not willing to re-sign J.D. Martinez. I definitely feel like he's a pretty significant downgrade from J.D. Martinez if you're going to talk about an everyday right fielder with some power. At the same time, it's a whole lot better than standing pat and doing nothing, right?
Yeah, and to be fair, I think we were going to talk about this move in a few seconds. They also added Jared Dyson on a pretty nifty little contract. So you know, if you kind of squint, they have the potential to, if not get, you know, if Souza's not able to claim that job full time, you have Dyson who can slot in either as a platoon type because you don't want him hitting against lefties or, you know, maybe taking over defensively. I don't know. Because, you know, Souza's defensive metrics are actually much better than you would expect. But I think the combination of Dyson and Souza will be league average or better. I'm just not a big believer that Souza's going to be anything close to a J.D. Martinez replacement in the truest sense of the word or anything like that. So I get it. I just don't think, like you said, that he's going to perform quite as he did last season. And then, you know, the other part of this we haven't talked about is Brandon Drury to the Yankees. I think that's a pretty sound move because they needed either a second baseman or third baseman. It's, in theory, they could still add Mike Moustakas or something. I know the last I saw that they were quote unquote swarming him like sharks or whatever. Drury, he kind of got overlooked in Arizona because he's not, like, let's not make him out to be more than he is. He's not, you know, some secret superstar or anything, but he's like, you know, he's fine. He can hit around the league average. He can give you, you know, decent at bats, you know, kind of a patient approach. He's going to strike out. He's really not going to walk. Doesn't necessarily have, you know, elite power or anything like that, but he can do a little bit of, you know, hitting, or excuse me, he can do a little bit of hitting. Well, I guess that's fair. He can do a little bit of hitting, and you know, he's also perfectly fine to slot in at second base until they decide to bring up Gleyber Torres.
Yeah, this is a really – I really like this move for the Yankees, bringing in Drury. You know, Nick Solak's actually not a bad prospect, and he's most of what they gave up to get Drury. But Solak's also the type of guy who might be Drury in a couple of years from the left side, which is great, but it's not special. Yeah. He's a fine – he's maybe a one-win player, maybe a two-win player. And I think he's acquired by the Yankees to be a backup. I don't think he is a long-term starter at third or short because this is a team that has Miguel Andujar. This is a team that has Gleyber Torres. This is a team that has Tyler Wade. And this is a team that probably is going to have Manny Machado next year. So this is not a guy who they need to be the everyday third baseman unless they want to give some guys some AAA seasoning to start the season, or Torres isn't recovering quickly enough from his elbow injury, or Andujar struggles out the gate in spring training. But he's a very useful secondary second base piece. He can stand at third base, where he's going to be better defensively than he was at second. He can hit a little bit. He hits from the right side, which is kind of a nice little compliment. He can be a short side platoon guy with a lot of good left-handed hitters. I really like this move. I think it's a good move for the team. I just, I wouldn't expect him to be the starting third baseman in July. I think Andujar or Torres is going to do that, and he's going to be kind of the super sub for this team.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. But, yeah, this is a nifty move for the Yankees, and you're right. I've heard good things about Slack, but realistically, if he turns into Brandon Drury, the Rays did well here. So you're a Yankees team. You have all that prospect depth. Why wouldn't you go out and make the swap to better your chances of being, very, very good out of the gate in 2018, as opposed to, having the same guy in maybe 2-3 years.
Yeah, if he's – I could see him being very much like Chase Headley was for the Yankees last year, which is not the worst thing in the world. Well, yeah, that's true. Also, the weird thing about Drury is you kind of forget he's only entering his age 25 season. So the Yankees are still young, which is kind of crazy to say.
Yeah, and they're still cheapish. I mean, the core is still cheap because they're all young and early in their earning phases. And again, that's not something you're used to really saying about the Yankees. So it's a weird world here in 2018 where the sabermetric sites are not really fond of what the Rays are doing, and everyone loves the Yankees' young core. What a wild – the Yankees are the plucky ones here. Like, the Yankees are the team you root for because they're trying and they're willing to spend money, and,
They've got the more fun and likable players, just like you were saying. Go ahead, root against Stanton and Judge and Sanchez. I dare you.
Right. Didi Gregorius. I mean, if he was on the Rays, I mean, he'd be like the most charismatic, likable player on the team by far. On the Yankees, we don't even mention him in the top three or four.
I know. It's wild. He's a fun dude. I'm really happy that he is the new Derek Jeter, because the old Derek Jeter has turned out to be a garbage guy.
And the only garbage guys, you do have to dock the Yankees for Chapman. But
That's true.
So to the Rays' credit, they don't have a known garbage person for once in their franchise history. So credit to them, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, they still have Chris Archer, who's probably, at least from my opinion, one of the best dudes in baseball, especially with all of his charitable works. And, they've got some good dudes on the team, too. Let's switch gears to our batting practice segment. Sean, you can lob us a couple of softballs, which I'm sure, given your experience pitching, you're not used to. But for us, you should lay up a little bit.
Oh, I'm absolutely used to it. But another guy being used to it is Joaquin Benoit signing with the Nationals for $1 million. There's your first softball.
He's horrible with Pitt. Horrible. I know there's only 8 innings, but he was so bad there. I mean, fine. It's fine. He has a history of being, a decent arm. I don't know if his time is up. I would have suspected it was up based on how he ended last season. But if you're the Nationals, you're going to win the National League East most likely. You can afford a $1 million bet to see if this guy has anything left in the tank.
Yeah, I agree with that. You say that he was horrible in Pittsburgh. That is probably true. It was 8 innings, so it's really
sample.
But also in that small sample, yes, he gave up all the runs, I believe it was. I think he gave up all the runs. Yes, he struck out nobody, and he gave up a ton of homers, and he walked everybody. So everything he did was bad. But Baseball Prospectus's deserved run average gives him a 2.79 for that period.
How?
Almost 5 runs less than his ERA. So our best case model that we've got, which is not great in small sample sizes, admittedly, did see something there that nobody else sees, including anybody who watched any of those starts. I like the move for the Nationals. Their bullpen was garbage, and he is coming off 2 seasons where he was slightly above replacement. And if you're the Nationals and you think he could be slightly above replacement again, $1 million for the guy is nothing, and it's a almost no-risk move at that price, so good for them.
2.79? He literally gave up 2 base runners an inning, and he gave up two home runs, and I don't understand that one, Rod. That one right there, you're like, that's going to – are we sure we're comfortable quoting DRA now? Because that one right there kind of boggles my mind. It was not like he was just giving up, you know, ground ball singles over and over again here. And okay, well, whatever. Let's move on. Brody,
let's call Jonathan Judge and get him on the line and get him to draw this out for us, because maybe this is not the best way to judge a pitcher's effectiveness in eight innings.
Yes. Ooh.
So the Marlins finally sign an outfielder. It's kind of weird to say, but Cameron Maybin going to Miami for $3.25 million. And, yeah.
It used to be a solid, you know, fourth outfielder type, and last year he was so bad. I don't think we realized how bad he was with Houston or LAA, because, you know, people were kind of surprised when he was – moved to Houston late in the year by the Angels. It's like, well, why would you help them? You know, they're already a super team at this point. Why help a team that you're, I know he was selected off waivers, but, you know, why even put that option out there? It's fine. He gives the Marlins, you know, a veteran faced around there. Obviously, the performance bar is not too high. I don't expect him to really produce that much anymore. If he's a league average bat, they did very well here, and odds are he's going to be below league average, and frankly, he's probably going to miss some time of injury, and that'll help their efforts to lock up a very good draft pick in 2019.
All right, good. We've got a good, solid difference of opinion here.
Uh-oh.
Because I spent a lot of time with Cameron Maybin this offseason. Not personally. He probably wants nothing to do with me, but I looked into his stats deeply from the time that he went to the Angels to the Astros to the time that I wrote him up for the BP annual. And I see this as a really smart move. Yes, I do not believe that he's going to play much because he's pretty much always injured. But Cameron Maybin is an exceptional base runner. He is still an exceptional base runner. Last year with the Angels, he was worth almost half a win just on the base paths. It doesn't show up a lot because he's not a very good hitter, and he was an awful hitter with the Astros. But he is an exceptional base runner. He can play a good, if not great, defensive center field, which is pretty impressive at this age. I think that he is a really good value pickup as possibly the best fifth outfielder in baseball and a fine fourth outfielder. But he does a couple of things very, very well, and I think that most teams getting him on a $3.25 million contract for 1 year, he's a remarkable stopgap, and he's probably going to be – to me, he's going to be worth a win. And so if that's the case, then he's a value pick. On the Marlins, this is kind of dumb because, yes, they need a warm body to play the outfield. They don't have any outfielders, so they need to get outfielders. But he is the wrong type of outfielder for this Marlins team, who is likely by the middle of the season going to have guys like Maggie Sierra and Lewis Brinson in their outfield, all of whom are center fielders. If I was going to get an outfielder and I was the Marlins, I didn't want to spend a lot of money, I would have gotten Carlos Gomez for the same price because he can actually hit. And I'm not certain that anybody who's going to play the outfield for the Marlins is going to hit this year. So if I'm the Marlins and I am willing to spend like $3 to $4 million on an outfielder, which in the first place, why would I do that? Because it's not going to get your team any goodwill. Your team's horrible. Nobody thinks you're trying to win this year. But if you are going to spend that money, go after somebody else. Maybin is the good complementary piece at the back of a 25-man roster for a good team. He's not the guy you should be relying on to be the, you know, guy of some value, can stand around and be a good veteran presence on a young team, because the young guys basically do what he does.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I did not expect us to spend so much time on Cameron Maybin when I saw his name. I'm going to be honest with you, but you make good points there. What's next?
I literally spent more time working on Cameron Maybin because of the BP annual than any other player.
Okay, but let's be honest. You know, the Call Me Maybe homage was really well done. So hats up to you.
Well, I appreciate that. After all that work, I was like, you know what, screw it, I'm just going to make it a song. Let me call Ben Parsley to help me write this up. As like, okay, well, you know, I can't give up. I have to sell out for the one good joke that I can come up with because everybody else in the annual is very clever and very funny, and I'm not. So it all kind of went to crap at that point. But, yeah, the work's been done.
So next we have Jesse Chavez returning home to Texas, 1 year. $1 million deal. The Rangers, who want to do a six-man rotation, now have six guys who are starting pitchers, but that's about where it ends. You have Bartolo Colon on a non-roster invite. You have Austin Bevin Dirks on an NRI, John Neese on an NRI. Yohander Mendez is probably going to get some innings this year. I mean, Is it just enough to have six pitchers who can start games, or
this is just another log on the death fire because you know they have Minor and they have Bush both trying to convert to the rotation. Not sure either of those is going to go particularly well, especially Bush because he's a 32-year-old who has started one game in his professional career. He's 5'8", which is pretty small as far as starters go. I don't know how the stuff's going to translate to throwing, you know. I mean, I think his career high in innings is around 80, and that's including the minors. So, realistically, not sure that's going to go well at all. Add Chavez, who can at least, you know, soak up some innings if you absolutely need it. It won't necessarily be cap quality innings, but, I mean, again, the alternative here is not quality either. So, well, it's whatever. I don't think I have a strong take beyond that it's fine. It's just not anything impressive.
Yeah, I think if you're the Rangers and you're going to try to do a six-man rotation and you're going to try to fill out that six-man rotation with a bunch of questionable guys who may not be able to go deep into games, you better get a boatload of depth. And I think that's what the Rangers are doing. Instead of getting good pitchers, they're getting a lot of depth. Jesse Chavez will be the long man in the rotation. He may need to back up somebody like Minor or Bush or Pfister from the fourth inning to the seventh. You know, twice a week. So if you're going to need a guy that does that, Chavez is a pretty good guy to do that. But yeah, with them going and getting Bevin Dirks and John Neese and those other guys, they're like just chock full of replacement level, maybe starting pitchers, maybe guys to only go three innings. And they're going to need a lot of those guys because their rotation has a lot of question marks.
Yeah.
So from a rotation with question marks to another rotation with question marks, the Twins signed Anibal Sanchez for $600,000. The Twins now have a rotation consisting of Jose Berrios, Jake Odorizzi, Kyle Gibson, Mejia, Anibal Sanchez, and Ervin Santana on the disabled list to start the year. So why are there reports saying that they're done looking for starting pitching?
That's a good question, but my only thought on this Anibal Sanchez deal is that I'm not sure there's any move anymore that a team could claim, hey, it's because of analytics, and we wouldn't buy in hook, line, and sinker because Sanchez has been horrendous the last few years, and it seems like the Twins were like, trust us, we're looking at analytics here, and everybody's like, all right, well, yeah, let's give them a chance. You know, realistically, I would be stunned if Sanchez is – I mean, again, I don't know, man. I don't like this one, really, if that's all they're going to do. I would really prefer them go out and get one of Cobb or Lynn, assuming they can't swim in the Jake Arrieta pool. And it seems like a missed opportunity to me, honestly. As much as I love the Odorizzi deal, that shouldn't have been the only addition they made. So.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. You know, I usually will say about one of these signings where you pay a guy $1 million or less that it's a no-risk deal. And I agree. This is pretty much a no-risk deal for the Twins. It's also pretty much a no-reward deal. I don't see any way that he's a guy who they want to have in their rotation for anything else other than a spot start because somebody's down with an injury or, you know, temporary fix. And just like you said, Odorizzi's deal is great. He wasn't enough. Then now they have Berrios and a bunch of three or four starters, and they really need a guy who could be a one or a two. So if this, to me, seems like the type of move you make when you pretty much are sure that Cobb or Lynn or Arrieta is not coming to Minnesota and you need depth. So great that somebody exists, but this is not a good enough rotation to put them at the forefront of the wildcard discussion anymore.
So we're going to go to San Francisco now. Tony Watson, 3 years, $7 million. Tony Watson, 3 years, $7 million. What?
Well, this is one of those CBT abatance deals where they a lot of escalators and whatnot, so it can actually get up to his market value. I don't know what the thresholds are. I didn't look into that, but I'm pretty sure it's just going to be like a quarter of a million for like 30 appearances, 35 appearances, 40 appearances, and so on. Much like what they did with Austin Jackson, where it's like he can earn a million if he gets 350 plate appearances or something. So that's my assumption there without looking. It's fine. You know, Watson saw his velocity rebound in season last year, was very good with the Dodgers late in the season statistically. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, the Giants needed some bullpen help, and the fact that they were able to get it this cheaply is great. Also, being a left-hander, I think they especially needed a left-handed arm out of that bullpen. I do think Watson's going to outperform his contract, even with any escalators in it. But at the same time, when you pitched that poorly for Pittsburgh last year, you know, of course, there's going to be some question marks about whether or not you're going to get the money you thought you were originally. Reuniting the Melanson-Watson duo that pitched so well in Pittsburgh, I don't really know why you would want to go out and replicate a Pittsburgh Pirates bullpen, but hey, do you, Giants. I don't see it as a bad deal.
So, RJ, to your point, he earns $3 million in 2018, $3.5 in 2019, has a $2.5 million option in 2020 with a $500K buyout. So $9 million guaranteed, could earn between $14 and $21 million over those 3 years with escalators and performance bonuses. So
you usually don't see that for left-hand relievers.
No, it's not a Boone Logan deal.
No.
What do we think of these new kind of deals where most of the money lies in escalators and incentives for basically CBT reasons?
Oh, I hate it. I mean, it feels like the NFL here where your chunk of your money is coming through non-guaranteed means, and I'm sure the owners would really love that because especially with these incentives like, you know, games played, plate appearances, those things are easily manipulated. You know, Austin Jackson slumps for 2 weeks, and all of a sudden you can justify playing Austin Slater over him because, hey, Slater is going to cost, you know, the same no matter what. Jackson could potentially earn, you know, an extra quarter of a million if he gets these plate appearances. So I hate it. I think it's very unfriendly to the players, and I don't want to see a league where this becomes the norm where, you know, a ton of the money is tied into how many games you appear in or whatever, because I fear that teams would find a way to manipulate that. And I think we've seen it before. I mean, a few seasons back, Brandon Beachy was literally one appearance away from getting like a half a million or a million or whatever. The Dodgers didn't bring him up the rest of the year. They would go through every ever arm on their roster before they would bring up Brandon Beachy. Now, to be fair, Beachy was awful. But the fact that they made that move when he was one game away, I don't know, the cynical part of me says they knew darn well what they were doing, and that wasn't some coincidence or whatever.
Well, and I tend to be very positive about the Angels in general, but you know, the whole issue with Bud Norris and Jesse Chavez last year where they were flip-flopped in the rotation and the bullpen is another example of this. I basically just agree with literally everything that you said, RJ. Nothing more to add.
So we have a couple more that we're going to roll off really quick. Colby Rasmus to the Orioles. Chris Tillman to the Orioles. Rasmus on a minor league deal. Tillman, 1 year, $3 million. So which one of these is going to turn into a net positive?
I mean, Rasmus has a way better chance, right? Assuming he is, you know, assuming whatever personal issues he was dealing with are behind him. He was actually very good last season when he did play with the Rays. Tillman was horrible. I mean, I don't know if he's in their opening day rotation. That kind of sours me on basically whatever else they could do because, you know, that should not be your – he should not be in your opening day rotation. He should be in the minors working his way back in because he was so bad last season. And I had the unfortunate pleasure of seeing him pitch twice late in the year. One time we went and saw him against Brett Anderson, and it was like, wow, this is not really a pitching matchup I want to see in 2017. The next time – it was supposed to be Bundy and Archer, and I was like, yeah, this is a pitching matchup I want to see. And then Bundy was scratched, and here came Tillman to throw a glorified BP. I mean, he was bad. I don't know why they're bringing anyone back from that squad last year they don't have to, because that was a bad bunch, and he was arguably the worst defender of it.
Yeah, the Tillman thing is – It's a little mind-boggling to me because I'm not sure anybody else would have given him that contract for that amount of money. I think he was one of those guys who looked like an NRI, minor league contract guy. I want him to get right, and it's really hard to get right when the chances are the Orioles are going to pop him in the third spot in that rotation or something like it, and we're going to lean on him. And I just don't think that's – I don't think that's a good situation for anything other than Chris Tillman's bank account. Make no mistake. Go get your money, Chris Tillman. Like, you deserved it. You've earned it over the time you spent with this team. And the fact that they want to reward you and bring you back for that contract is great. But I don't think he's going to be very good this year either.
He should warm up to Loyalty by Kendrick Lamar, because that's the only song I can think of when you're talking about all this stuff.
Yeah. I mean Rasmus, I think he steps right into the opening day lineup. He could be a really nice, platoon, strong side of a platoon, maybe give Austin Hayes some early run when he's ready to come up as the platoon option on the other side with him. But I guess, he's kind of a polarizing dude where a lot of guys don't really like him so much. But after stepping away from baseball, I'm glad to see him come back, and I hope he's in a better headspace right now. And this is not a bad deal at all for the Orioles. I feel like they kind of got lucky if that's the team he chose to come back on an NRI with.
Yeah, I think if you flip the Rasmus and Tillman deals, I would have believed that as well. But with the Orioles, they have two Rule 5 guys in their bullpen. They have one new guy in their rotation in Andrew Cashner. Does anybody want to play for the Orioles or pitch for the Orioles?
Yeah. Of course people want to pitch for the Orioles. The Orioles tend to be very look at the dedication they're showing to Chris Tillman. Look at all the free agent pitchers who don't have jobs. Yes, starting pitchers will want to pitch for the Royals.
Orioles.
Do the Royals want starting pitchers to pitch for them? I don't know.
Moving on now. Peter Moylan signed with the Braves. Speaking of loyalty, this is third stint with the Braves, I believe. He actually was going to be a coach at one point for them, and he pitched so well that they had to bring him to the majors. He spent last year with the Royals. This seems like a nice gesture. He'll probably be perfectly functional middle reliever until he's not, and then he can go back to coaching. But nice little – you see, that's, kind of loyal as well, but that's how you do loyalty when the player is actually productive, is you can get praised for it.
Can you believe that this guy was worth almost two wins – by a warp on Baseball Prospectus last year? No pitcher, I think, was quite as anonymous last year as Peter Moylan. Pecota projects that'll regress heavily. I mean, he was barely ever worth that, even in his heyday with Atlanta when he was pitching, 80 to 90 games a season. So this is great. Good for the Braves. The Braves love their old pitchers, so good for them.
So we have Jabari Blash being traded to the Angels from the Yankees. So
he can't hit. Let's just put it out there. He can't hit. He has his power, but he can't hit. I don't know what else to say.
What are you trying to say here, RJ?
Maybe if I change my, how I'm presenting this, he cannot, how the children say, hit.
It's kind of funny to me, Jabari Blash is like, okay, I'm on the Yankees. Yeah, Aaron Judge, Jacoby Ellsbury, Brett Gardner, Giancarlo Stanton, Aaron Hicks. There's not much of a chance I'm going to play this year, but at least I'm getting traded to another team. Wait a second. It's the Angels. Shit. not much of a chance I'm going to play this year. He's the type of guy who needs to stick with a AAA team somewhere for 8 years and be the face of that AAA franchise. Maybe that's going to be Salt Lake City and hit 30 bombs a season in AAA in the PCL and, make his home there and try to go after Mike Hessman's record or something like that. That's what I hope for him.
So next we have Forrest Whitley being suspended 50 games. Provides the Astros pretty decent cover not to bring him up this year, even at the end, right?
No. I don't know about that. They had enough depth. I think they're going to justify leaving him down anyway, so shouldn't affect his prospect stock or anything like that. It shouldn't affect his actual standing with the club or anything like that either. So I think this is just an unfortunate incident. What can you do here? It seemed like the story I had seen, and I don't know if it was confirmed, is that he took a stimulant for a long drive back from a college baseball game, and that's what he got popped for, which is, again, unfortunate, but doesn't necessarily speak much to, character flaw or what have you.
Yeah, I believe the same thing. I'm not a fan of suspensions for recreational drug use. I'm not a proponent of recreational drug use, but I don't care to see MLB policing that sort of thing. So I'm with you. I don't think it'll affect his prospect status. I don't think it'll affect his career in any way other than give him some more vague makeup concerns that people forget about once he starts winning games, which will probably be by the end of this year or the start of next year.
Yep.
And finally, Rajay Davis and Carlos Torres to Cleveland. I guess wrap us up with some Rajay Davis talk.
Well, here's the thing. I don't think these moves do anything other than give the Indians a little extra depth, which they tend to need every year. So I don't think that's bad at all. Like, this is a team that always tends to dip into their sixth outfielder or their 10th relief pitcher. So good for them. I think one of the underrated things to talk about this offseason is that I think the Cleveland Indians are worse than they were last year. And I don't, kind of like I feel with the Diamondbacks, I don't think they're a lot worse, but I think they're a little worse. And I think if you're a little worse than you were the year before, that's not a good thing. So I'm hoping that they're not. I hope that they prove me wrong, but these moves don't change that.
They're depending on internal progress from Brantley, from Kipnis, and even from Francisco Mejia. I will know, I think the Torres deal is more likely to pay off than the Davis deal because he was so bad last year, Davis was, and basically his entire game is speed at this point. Whereas with Torres, you can kind of see him filling, let's say, a Jeff Manship role from a few years ago.
Where
he can give you, last 2 years, he's thrown 82 and 72 innings. Now, are they going to be high quality innings?
Nope.
Probably not, but there's value in having a guy in the bullpen who can go out there and give you 70-plus innings of medium or low-leverage pitching, especially when you're probably going to be pretty good and you get to beat up on the Tigers and the Royals and other questionable teams all year long. So I could see him easily, finishing 10 games just because, 10, 15 games because, they're blowouts and they don't want to use Allen or Miller or anyone who's of great importance to them.
Agree completely. So that'll do it for today's episode. I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you want to follow along with the show, you can follow DFA Podcast on Twitter at DFA Podcast. You can read RJ at CBS Sports MLB, and you can read myself at Baseball Prospectus. But thank you all for listening to the show today, and we will see you next time.